Okay, so this week we're largely going to be kind of dancing around the topic of black holes. So some of it's not going to be particularly peripheral. We're going to, like today, we're going to really face the black hole dead on and actually look at what it means to be a black hole and talk about causal structure. But, you know, some of the other lectures in the week, I might sort of have a slight digression. We're going to look at back at the Einstein-Hilbert action, but come in and do it slightly more completely, giving it a boundary term. And, you know, sort of, so some of the, we'll also begin to think about thermodynamics, but essentially all of the sort of the thing that's kind of going to be in our minds this week is the black hole. So I was just dropping a rental car off this morning, and the lady behind the counter sort of started to ask, well, what do you do at the Perimeter Institute? You know, do you do research sort of thing? And I said, well, yes, you know, I do some teaching, but yes, I do some research. So she asked me what on. And so I'm always a little bit nervous about starting this conversation. But I said, well, I guess mainly black holes. And she was like, wow. So I ended up having this sort of 5-minute discussion about, you know, what's trying to explain the sort of things that I, you know, did around black holes. And I think this is the really cool thing about this topic. It's something that, you know, we are energized about as researchers, even fairly experienced, in my case, researchers. I still find myself, you know, enjoying dealing with black holes. And it's also something that, you know, the general public seems to really enjoy as well. So I think, you know, this is kind of a fun topic. And it's sort of interesting how something that is, on the one hand, you know, we've already derived the black hole. It's mathematically quite simple. You know, I was saying to her, I can write it on one line mathematically. So it's very clean. And yet, amazingly, that sort of very abstract, very clean thing is out there in nature. Normally, when we deal with the real world, we have to make all sorts of compromises and sort of things get quite messy quite quickly, and yet the black hole does seem to be fairly clean. So anyway, sorry, just thought I'd share some of my enthusiasm for the topic. So what we're going to do today is we're going to go back to our Schwarzschild solution, the one that we're all very familiar with, and I want to spend a bit of time talking about causal structure of that solution, so why we call it a black hole. So I know that you kind of already have this intuition. You know there's an event horizon, so on and so forth. So we'll just look at that in a little bit more detail. And then I want to talk a little bit about the Kerr solution, the rotating black hole, just so that you kind of see what's similar and what's different, as well as how we know what the horizon is in the Kerr solution, because the Kerr has this rather interesting little quirk that when we first sort of meet the black hole, the Schwarzschild black hole, we kind of think of the horizon as GTT going to zero, but it's not quite that simple. So let's start with our Schwarzschild solution. So for the moment, I'm just going to forget about the cosmological constant. Because it's not really going to add value. And let's sort of think. We know, and of course, when Schwarzschild wrote down his solution, he knew too that there is this problem at R equals 2gm. Now, interestingly, if we also do a Newtonian analysis of escape velocities, we find that 2gm is kind of when the escape velocity reaches the speed of light for an object. So people had already theorized about black holes back in the 18th century. So there's Laplace and Michel, and who both had this notion of a dark star. So again, in the 18th century, it was finally experimentally proven that light had a finite velocity. So thinking about what the consequences of a finite velocity were, you know, were, this was a sort of philosophical piece of fun or whatever, game. So people had already theorized, so I guess I should just put, I think it's Mitchell. So from the perspective of the 18th century philosophers, having a place where light couldn't escape was a curiosity, something interesting, but not the end of the world, because there was this notion of absolute time. So, you know, to get an idea of absolute time, just kind of watch Star Trek, right? Because there's always this notion that there's a definite future, even though they go at warp speed, right? Faster than the speed of light, they still travel to the future somehow. So I always forgive them by saying it's cosmological time, but whatever. It's really, it does violate the laws of physics. So from their perspective, they didn't mind. But from our perspective, post-Einstein, we're worried because we can't, you know, once light can't escape, nothing can. So that's a causal boundary to the space-time. So here, the fact that the metric breaks down at 2gm is something we have to worry about. So the first thing we do is we think, well, right, light is our sort of make or break object. So a photon, if a photon can get to us, then that person can communicate with us. So we need to look at what happens to light rays. So that means we want to sort of be able to easily identify a light ray from here. And so the obvious thing to do is to introduce this tortoise coordinate, which I'm guessing you've already seen. So this is the R star coordinate, where we simply integrate dr over 1 minus 2gm on R. And so the idea is that we'll replace this object here by 1 minus 2gm on R, dr star squared. So that's the idea. So we pull out the common factor, and then we have dt squared minus dr star squared, which is like dt plus or minus, so dt plus dr star times dt minus dr star. So that sort of gives us our null or light-like coordinates. So I'm just going to write 2gm as R plus for a bit of shorthand. It's just saying it's a horizon. It's a root of this potential. So now I'm going to define null coordinates. So these are the Kruskals. So what we do is we take the t plus or minus r star and we exponentiate it. And we're sort of taking a particular ratio for that exponential. So hopefully you can read the u's got two minus signs in it. And the v's got no minus signs in it. So if I do this, then du dv So looking at du, well, du is just u times minus 1 over 2r plus dt minus dr star. And similarly, dv is v times 1 over 2r plus dt plus dr star. So I get my dt squared minus dr star squared, which was kind of what I had up here. And then I've got uv. And then I've got 4r plus squared. So now I look at what uv is. So if I multiply u and v together, I get a minus r plus squared. And in the exponentials, I see that the t's cancel off and the r stars add. So I end up with should have lost the sign there. So but then I know what my R star is. My R star is just R plus a logarithm. So R star on R plus and then I've got the log. So I end up with R minus R plus on R plus. So now, if I compare what I've got here for du dv with what I've got up here for my ds squared, I see that my ds squared leads with a du dv piece. So now what happens at r plus? Well, as r goes to r plus, I get 4 for the first piece. I get it 1 over e for the second bit, and then I get du dv. So all of a sudden, I've got something that just isn't singular. So that was the reason for exponentiating in the capital U and the capital V. It was simply because the null coordinates that we originally defined, the t plus or minus r, well, we didn't. I kind of skipped over it, but you may well have seen it. The t plus or minus r star, those tend to infinity as we approach the horizon. But if we exponentiate them, then as long as we have it going to an exponent of minus infinity, something just goes to zero. So we've already seen that if we take u times v, we get a pure function of r. So if r is constant, then u times v is constant. So similarly, if I look here, if I divide u and u by v, then I get a function of t only. So t is constant, corresponds to u over v being constant. So we've now identified our coordinate lines of constant t and r. So the other thing that we need are interesting points, which are the horizon, or what we now know is going to be a horizon. So if r is r plus, then this is my, I put my uv here. Uv goes like r minus r plus. So that tells me uv is zero. And r equals zero is uv is r plus squared. So if we just step back to our original argument with our sort of original Schwarzschild coordinates, our capital U is negative because it's an exponential of something, so that's always positive. And then we've got a minus sign in front of it. So if u v, if, you know, if v is positive, u is negative, if we look here, but this is where u and v have to be either both positive or both negative. So that tells us that r equals zero is not covered by these original coordinates, which we sort of know because we see if we try to go to r less than 2gm, our GTT changes sign, etc. So what we end up with, our null lines are always at 45 degrees. So this is our v coordinate, this is our u coordinate. So we are out here, that's us, this quartile. So we want u negative, so that's fine, and v positive, so we live in that particular quartile. Then this is r equals 2gm, because r equals 2gm is u, v is zero, so it's u is zero or v is zero. So we now see that our horizon, or our putative horizon, is not just a single point. It's not just or a line, r equals 2gm, at some arbitrary t. Instead, it has this interesting light cone structure. So we have something more interesting. So let's look at our r equals constant, t equals constant. So this is the t equals constant line, because its u is proportional to v. And then r equals constant is a hyperboloid in that quartile. So this is r equals constant. So those are our coordinate lines in our patch of Schwarzschild spacetime. R is zero, looks like a hyperboloid in these two quartiles. And so what we kind of see is that our patch, so this is our patch, can be extended actually in two ways. So we can go through here, and that is moving to our future. We can also extend through here, which is sort of to our past. So we find that there are kind of two in this very sort of fixed mathematical solution. There are two ways we can identify our horizon. And so we call this one, if you like, the past horizon. And that sometimes gets called a white hole because nothing can really get into it. I mean, although I've drawn the green arrows going that way, that's drawing the way we are extending our coordinate system. Whereas as observers, we always have to travel to the future. So things only come out of here, whereas things only fall into the other part of the horizon, which is our future horizon, and that is the black hole. And then, of course, we have over here, we've got a copy of our original Schwarzschild solution, because we can keep extending all the way over to, what's in that corner? Negative V, positive V, sorry. So that is telling us about the structure of our, the full structure of our maximally extended Schwarzschild space-time. Yep.
What about the central point of this diagram? The central point of the diagram, is it any...
The center point?
Yes.
Yeah, so that is... So, okay, I mean, so I'm going to come back to sort of... Let me just write this down before I forget. So that's actually part of the event horizon. We call it, if you like, the bifurcation point, because it's where the past and the future event horizons meet. So geometrically, you should think of that sort of the whole horizon structure as being, once you pan out, it literally is a light cone. So that's just simply, if you look at also, it's so it's R equal, so it's you know, T equals constant. If you look at that T equals constant line, and I mean, it's not something we can ever physically access, but if we look here, this T equals constant surface and say, what's that geometry? Well, all I do is I just simply erase the dt squared piece there, if you like, and ask, what does it do? Well, this is my asymptotically flat space. And so what happens is my, this is, if you like, a sketch or a cartoon of what the geometry looks like. So I have to stop at 2gm because I can't go beyond 2gm in terms of what's left once I've blotted out the dt squared piece. But once I know that my space-time extends through, then I've just gone into a mirror image. So I simply take another copy and patch them together. So this is kind of what that surface looks like. And this is your sort of candidate wormhole. So that's kind of a nice picture of what the black hole looks like, but it's convenient when we're studying black holes to actually, rather than have something that's got coordinates running off the page, we like to have a compact picture. So once again, rather than, whoops. So one, rather than kind of do anything hand waving, once again, thanks Penrose, we have now a formal sort of way of doing this. So we want to shrink our picture onto a finite size. So what we're going to do is kind of shrink it along the null direction. So we pull this infinite range of V to a finite range and the infinite range of U to a finite range. So we can easily do that by taking the arctangent. So I'm just writing down the correspondence for V to P, but same for U. So the zero of V is P is zero, obviously. The horizon is when the tangent of P is one, so P is pi on four, and then as V goes to infinity, we kind of hit pi on two. We then notice that tan of P plus Q So finally, if we kind of think about what's happened, we've shrunk our, so we've taken our u coordinate, and that runs between minus pi on 2 and pi on 2. We've got our v coordinate, which is now the p. So this is p, this is q, and both of them run from minus pi on 2 to pi on 2. So then my p is cut off at pi on 2 here, minus pi on 2 there. And you'd think, you know, you might have a diamond, except you can't go beyond r equals 0. So that's p plus q is pi on 4. So that puts a cutoff here and a cutoff here. So I end up with this picture. I've kind of straightened out that singularity at r equals 0. So this is what we call a Penrose diagram, but strictly it was also developed by Brandon Carter, so more or less at a very similar time as Penrose was developing this notation. And so what it does is it encodes the causal structure of the black hole. So we have here the singularity. And we have our event horizon. And then these are a sort of form of infinity that I'll come back to and give a bit more discussion on in just a moment. But because light rays are always maintained at 45 degrees in these pictures, it means that our observers, if we start here, we either fall into the black hole, in which case we must hit the singularity, or we escape to infinity. If we're time-like, we have to go to this point up here. So that is time-like infinity. And it's sometimes called I plus. And here, correspondingly, we've got an I minus, which is past time-like infinity. Sorry. This point here is space-like infinity. And then the only way, what are these lines here? So the only way you can hit one of those lines is if you're traveling at the speed of light. And so these, I'll do it over here. These are future or past null infinity. So these are called scry plus and scry minus. So what you see is that not only does the event horizon have a more interesting structure than you might have imagined, if you just thought about it from the TR coordinates point of view, but actually infinity's now got a more interesting structure. Infinity has a future, it has a past via these null infinities, and it's also got a space-like and time-like component. So it's kind of, you know, you start by analyzing this causal structure, you kind of start to see, you know, your space-time is maybe a little more interesting than you thought it was. So another example is Minkowski space. So here's another Penrose diagram. So what we do or what we've done here is we've ignored the two spheres because the two spheres just have area 4 pi r squared. So we kind of just forget about them. They go along for the ride. So above every point on that picture, we've still got a two sphere. And it's the same here. But now our u and v are just t minus r and t plus r. So they're okay, that, you know, we don't have to do much work. And r greater than zero tells us that v is greater than u, or tan p is greater than tan q. And so what we have here, if we start off looking at our null coordinates, we've got half of the plane. And then when we compactify, we get a little flag. So here, this is our I naught, I minus, I plus, scry plus, scry minus, and no horizon. So that's kind of, you know, looking at causal structures. And of course, as I said, we're here, I think when we first meet Penrose diagrams, we meet them in the context of just planar diagrams because we have this kind of symmetry where the sphere is hovering over. But, you know, there are more complicated space-times where, you know, it's actually more appropriate to draw a three-dimensional picture. So, just to warn you that don't expect everything to be two-dimensional. So interestingly, although Schwarzschild found his solution just months after Einstein's general relativity paper was published, it took another 50-odd years before the rotating black hole was discovered by Roy Kerr. So this is kind of important because, of course, astrophysical black holes will be rotating. So anything that's generically formed from matter, there's, you know, is going to have an element of rotation in it. And indeed, it's almost a puzzle when we find black holes that don't rotate very much. So what is the Kerr solution? Well, you can write it down in two different ways, collecting the terms. Phew. Okay, so that's the Kerr black hole. So you can see it's a sort of step up from Schwarzschild in terms of complication, but I stubbornly kept it on one line. So what's different about it? Well, you've got this cross term, dt d phi. So what you mean, given that when we talked about the SO3 killing symmetries of a metric, I showed you that the GT theta, GT phi, etc., had to vanish. So if we have a GT phi, this tells us that we no longer have an SO3 symmetry. So this does not have an SO3 symmetry. However, if you look at the components of the metric, you see nothing that depends on T and nothing that depends on phi. So although we can sadly lose our spherical symmetry, we do still have some symmetry. So we've got two killing vectors. And if we look at our cross term, dt d phi, it's slightly easier really to see in this format. So this is kind of writing our metric now as block diagonal. We've chosen to kind of pair up the t and phi pieces in a particular way. And this way is actually best for identifying the causal structure. But you sort of look and you see that if you have a sort of T phi piece, it's got this A in it. So A is telling you about rotation. So A is the rotation parameter, and it's actually identified as the angular momentum of the black hole, J, divided by the mass of the black hole, M. And so our metric functions depend on this A. It's kind of normalized momentum. So what are the interesting features of this solution? Well, we see that just like when we've got a 1 minus 2 GMNR multiplying dt squared, here we've got instead 1 minus 2 GMR over sigma. So we have a surface. Where GTT tends to zero. And then we also have a point where GRR tends to infinity. So that's really so GRR blows up when delta is zero. So we have to kind of figure out where the horizon is, because if we look at Schwarzschild, we could say, okay, it's where GTT goes to zero, or maybe we should say it's where GRR blows up. It's the same thing for Schwarzschild, but it's absolutely not the same thing for Kerr. So we kind of have to make our minds up and figure out which one it is. So let me just check about this GTT blowing up. Let's find the roots of this. Should have done them the other way around, sorry. So these are the points where GTT tends to zero. So if I take the minus root, maybe I should call them capital R. plus or minus. So the r minus, this g squared m squared minus a squared cos squared theta, this square root is less than that square root. So the two square roots, this is less than or equal to that. So either our plus root lies outside r plus. So here r plus is bigger than or equal to r plus, and r minus is less than or equal to r minus. And so, you know, we need to kind of look at our plus roots because we're, you know, we're only interested in what we see from outside the black hole. So what's the significance of GTT going to zero? Well, if GTT goes to zero, that means that a time-like observer cannot remain at rest relative to infinity, because something that was at rest relative to infinity would have no changing radial component and no changing angular components. So it would only have a T component. And so if that goes to zero, that's kind of, you know, essentially saying that you're locally traveling somehow at the speed of light. So is this our event horizon or is it something else? So remember, the idea of an event horizon is really, if I use it literally by words, it's the limit of events we can see. So what does that mean? It's the limit where if we look at all of the light rays that come to infinity, so it's the boundary between the ones that escape and the ones that don't. So what we're going to do is look at geodesics, but they're quite, the general geodesic equation is actually quite complicated, so we're going to make it slightly easier. We'll take theta is pi on 2. So we'll look at equatorial geodesics. Now, interestingly, equatorial geodesics, cos theta is 0, are where the discrepancy between this root and this root is the greatest. So it will really pin down which of those two roots we should be taking. So the first thing is we're going to use our trusted killing vectors to help us out. So I'm going to think about my geodesic equation. So here, x dot mu is the tangent vector of my geodesic. But I'm going to ask, suppose I dot my the tangent vector of my geodesic with a killing vector, what happens? That gives me a scalar. So now I'm quite clearly using abstract index notation. So this second term is the, just my geodesic equation, so that vanishes because my, hang on, getting all typed. So the second term vanishes because I'm on a geodesic. Meanwhile, the first term vanishes because we have a killing vector. So I think this is probably in a tutorial somewhere, but if not, then it's an exercise I'm setting you in the class, which is to verify that the lead derivative acting on the killing vector is just the saying that the symmetrized covariant derivative, the killing vector, vanishes. So that tells us K mu dotted with X dot is a conserved quantity. So we have our two killing vectors, d by dt and d by d phi. Therefore, our geodesics have two conserved quantities. So I'll look at each in turn. So if k is d by dt, I'm going to call this conserved quantity E. So this is, of course, intuitively related to the energy, or our energy as an observer. And if I put in what it is for Kerr, I have some combination of T dot and phi dot. So what this is telling me is that my local energy, or the sort of the thing that really is dual to kind of a time-like symmetry along my geodesic, is not just about the change in the T coordinate. It's a combination of T and phi. So what's this sort of telling me? Well, it's telling me that the local sort of real time is kind of dragged relative to time at infinity. So we have this notion that the rotation of the black hole is kind of dragging. It's called frame dragging. It's kind of dragging round the space-time as we move in, where sort of as we move in here, this term tends to zero at infinity. But as we move in, our local time is kind of being pulled round with the black hole. So at the equator, theta is pi on 2, which is where this effect should be maximal. So that's my energy equivalent. So next we'll look at d by d phi. So here again, we have this mix between phi dot and t dot terms. And this is really what we would think of as our angular momentum, our real angular momentum, if we were orbiting an object. So if there's no rotation, so if we ignored A, this would just be r squared phi dot. So that is angular momentum. And once again, it's not just a phi dot because our frames are being dragged. So then we collect together So I'm just introducing specifically for this discussion, alpha and beta. If you see the first few letters of the Greek alphabet, then those are just meant to represent the T and phi coordinates. So this is a sort of little, this is the collection of the conserved momenta, the conserved charges for the geodesic. So if we ask what is the length of that P, P squared, then it's the same as taking the length of just the T phi part of our tangent vector. So this is E squared GTT minus 2EH GT phi plus H squared G phi phi. Okay, so that's just, hope you can see it, I'll try to leave the corner free. So I don't know how much practice you had solving the geodesic equation in the first part of the course, but the geodesic equation, when we first meet it, we see it as a second order ODE. It's grad T of T vanishes for the affinely parameterized geodesic. But I'm struggling to remember if I've ever solved that second order geodesic equation, maybe, but, you know, less than a number of fingers on my hand. What I usually do when I'm interested in geodesics is I use all sorts of ways of avoiding doing a second order ODE because we use our symmetries to kind of reduce some of the degrees of freedom. And then we use the fact that along our geodesic, the length of the tangent vector is conserved. So in essence, the reason why I'm finding this P squared is because P squared directly inserts into the length of the tangent vector squared. So my geodesic equation is that. I've killed the theta coordinate, so I've already made my life simpler. And so all I'm left with is the r coordinate. I have p squared as a function of r and my constants. And so what I've now got is a first order nonlinear equation for r. So here, this eta is one for time like geodesics. So if I was interested in orbits around a black hole, I would use eta equals 1, and eta is 0 for null geodesics or light, and that's what I use if I'm interested in the horizon structure, or actually just interested, as we are now, in the light escaping from near a black hole. So I can rewrite this in a rather useful form as simply r dot squared plus what we could interpret as an effective potential. So this is an easy way of getting qualitative statements about geodesics. So let me just carry on with my thought about the horizon. So for light, this is what I need to look at. R dot squared is P squared delta over R squared. So let me have a look at delta P squared from that expression there. This is what I get. Now, I'm not interested in proving something general about the horizon because I want this to be a sort of as simple an argument as possible. So I'm going to make things as easy as possible. So let's first look at E. So this is a general statement. So we've now got a light-like geodesic. So that means that the tangent vector has zero length. So you know that once you've got an affine parameter for a null geodesic, you can always rescale it by a constant. So I can always rescale my affine parameter to set E equals 1. So my first simplification is to set E equals 1. So now I don't have a spurious symbol following me around. The second simplification I'm going to make is I'm going to look at an extreme Kerr black hole. So what do I mean by this? Well, we've got this notion that we've got this additional parameter to Schwarzschild, which is the rotational parameter A. And if we look at the roots for these various functions, the delta or our GTT, we see that if GM becomes less than A, that delta no longer has a root. And so at least from the spatial part of the metric, I can go all the way into R equals 0 without the R coordinate becoming time-like. So my R coordinate is always space-like as I go into R equals 0, which makes me think that's probably a bad idea because then I can go right to the singularity. So there is a limit that I can choose for my A, which is A equals GM, when there's still a point at which delta is zero, but it's about to disappear. So that's what we call our extreme limit or extreme Kerr black hole. So this is a black hole that is maximally rotating. So this is as fast as it can go. So I'm going to take that to kind of make things, again, easier. So my delta P squared now becomes this. So now I see that I've sort of got, if I multiplied by R, I would have a cubic. So here we're saying that R dot squared is P squared delta on R squared. So if I have a sensible, I've got to have a root here for R dot squared, so that has to be positive. So this delta P squared has to be positive. So I need to look for where the roots are of this polynomial here. So I see that there's a root H minus A, because there's a root of h minus a here, and this is h minus a times h plus a. So there's a root of h minus a. And then I have two more roots, which are so I can factor out that r minus h minus a, and I'm left with a quadratic, which also has two roots, but each of those roots are inside h minus a. So h minus a, this one is the outermost root. So if I have this positive root, if r dot squared is positive, then I can choose an r dot that is positive. Therefore, I have an outgoing null geodesic. And since I'm going to say that, you know, here, as long as r is bigger than h minus a, there's no further possible root. So that geodesic can escape. So now, what can that tell me? Well, let me take h going to 2a. What happens if h goes to 2a? Well, if h is 2a, h minus a becomes a. And so that tells me that I can always go from just a little bit outside a, delta p squared is positive, and therefore I have the possibility of an escaping null geodesic. So in this case, I know that r equals a is actually the event horizon because I can escape from r just a little bit bigger than a. Meanwhile, if I look at the condition for GTT to be zero, what happens to GTT for this extremal limit? Oh, find the wretched thing. So at theta is pi on 2. No, I don't want theta is pi on 2. Yes, I do. So at r equals a, GTT is quite firmly negative. So that tells us that although GTT equals zero is interesting, it is not the event horizon. Instead, because I said, if you imagine trying to remain at rest relative to infinity, as you hit GTT as zero, you're sort of essentially traveling at the speed of light. This is called the ergosphere. Because it is the limit of where we can remain at rest. Relative to infinity. So let me just finish by drawing a cartoon of the black hole. In these coordinates. So this is going to be the theta, and of course, that's my r coordinate. So the event horizon I'm claiming is delta equals zero. So here we have r equals r plus. So this is our event horizon. But then our ergosphere, what does that look like? Our ergosphere horizon, whatever. So if cos theta is one, it gives me the same. So at the poles, it's in exactly the same place. But in the equator, it's much further out. So we get this sort of egg-like surface here. So actually, this is our ergo region, where we have to be in motion. So that's why we call it the ergosphere or ergo region, because we have to move relative to infinity. Inside, in that region, we have to be in motion relative to infinity. So this kind of leads to all sorts of interesting processes. You can imagine kind of going into that region with a spaceship, which you're allowed to. You still haven't killed yourself because you can still escape, you know, outside the event horizon. But you could imagine kind of throwing stuff, sort of separating part of your spaceship and throwing it into the black hole in such a way that you counteract the motion of the black hole, thereby increasing your velocity. So you end up coming out faster than you went in, having thrown or reduced the angular momentum of the black hole. So that leads to sort of interesting ideas about extracting energy from black holes. So that's called the Penrose process. So I'll stop there.